I wondered what he was like when rested. I want you to meet somebody, to work with her. I will be returning to the bush soon, but she will have what you need. Yes, sir, I responded. He called her name and tilted his head to the side of the room. It was not one of the Bond babes. An older, heavy-set lady with thick glasses introduced herself. Her hand was large and soft and limp. She looked like a nice person, maybe somebody's favorite aunt. We exchanged contact information. I provided her a place where we could meet the following week. She would be on an urban street corner. I would pick her up in a car. For the next year, I would meet her regularly, mostly in rolling car meetings at night. She never missed a meeting. She never failed to deliver, providing details of the insurgency's progress and the geopolitical consequences of their war. We discussed the erratic flow of funding, the torturous supply chain, tribal politics, and battles past, present, and future. The fight was about physical geography. The rivers, in particular, posed monumental challenges. The fight concerned complex plots of subversion. The fight was also about the leaders of the insurgency and the faltering government. What were their plans and intentions? Leadership, I learned, was a key component. What motivated these people to fight? What did they want to achieve beyond victory? I asked many questions. Her answers would lead to more questions. I never seemed to have enough time. I lived up to my side of the bargain, providing her the official U.S. government position on matters of interest to her organization. At her request, I even provided my opinions. The United States still recognized the government that the insurgents sought to overthrow, so there was no overt, or in this case covert, support for the rebels. But as the CIA representative, I offered an approved, discreet channel that the State Department would not risk. This intelligence liaison relationship, I eventually realized, also served as an important proto-diplomacy function. We were laying the groundwork for diplomatic relations when the victorious rebel army turned into a government of a recognized state. I never did seek to recruit my interlocutor as a unilateral source. I did not need to, given the wealth of information, nor did I want to risk derailing what would evolve into one of the CIA's most successful liaisons on the continent. My COS had the foresight to pursue this relationship, and he took the risk of giving me, a liaison rookie, the opportunity. With good and patient partners, I managed the account with growing confidence and effectiveness. I recall fondly the frumpy lady in thick glasses, with her easy manner and her measured, mellifluous tones. She looked as little like an insurgent as I could imagine. As my first instructor and partner in liaison operations, I could not have asked for better. Foreign Government Liaison. My first introduction to an official foreign government liaison service was almost by happenstance, through the pursuit of a unilateral target. The recruitment target, short and dowdy, was 20 years my senior. The CIA's dossier on her, known as a 201 file, outlined her study and understanding of the United States. In contrast, my knowledge of her country was limited. She was a relatively senior foreign official. I was a junior CIA officer. She focused on economics. I worked mostly on geopolitical intelligence, particularly counterintelligence and insurgencies. We had little in common. Relying on two foreign liaison services, separated from each other by several thousand miles and unknown to each other, I would pursue this recruitment target off and on for the next 6 years. I was never declared to the first service, although they may have suspected my affiliation. To the second liaison service, I needed no introduction. The country I was in served as the site for a large international conference, attended by several hundred government officials from all parts of the globe. Several of these conference participants were prime recruitment targets, but they were beyond the reach of CIA stations in their home countries, where the security services kept close tabs on U.S. officials, especially suspected CIA officers. These security services also monitored their own government officials' contact with foreigners. In these restrictive operational environments, recruitment opportunities were rare. Now, by contrast, these targets were congregated in an environment controlled by the local intelligence service and the CIA. The local operatives, of course, wanted to understand all they could about this horde of foreign visitors. The station obliged, sending reports on those foreign officials, at least those from adversarial nations, to the host service. Our local liaison partners used this information for their own purposes, like briefing their political leadership. In this way, the CIA helped the local service protect their nation's interest and advance their own relationship with their political masters. The grateful local service provided the station daily tactical information on selected targets, derived from surveillance, technical collection, and sources at the conference. There was clear common interest. The local service knew that we wanted to pitch some of these targets, and they had only one request: no flaps. They did not want any embarrassment, any protests from foreign governments, or any newspaper headlines. In other words, as the COS explained to us, do what you want, just don't screw it up. The station hosted only a handful of operations officers. The target list was far more than we could tackle in only a few days, so we each had one or two targets assigned to us. The CIA might have another shot at the other targets at another conference another time. In the small office that I shared with two other junior officers, I studied her file summary. We knew her government position, her family and educational background, and her potential intelligence value. Working with a station analyst who had earlier consulted with HQS, I compiled a mental list of the subjects of obvious interest to her. Family was at the top. The next day I was at the conference as an observer, with a name tag stuck on the lapel of my suit coat. I sat through one plenary session, scanning the crowd and trying to match names, bios, and photos with the participants. Otherwise, I was bored out of my mind. The conference seemed to serve primarily as a forum for one platitude after another. I loathed the tedium of static surveillance, made worse because I could not even spot the target. On the final morning of the conference, I found her, right where the liaison had reported. She was flipping through some reading material alone during a coffee break. With no time and no other options, I simply approached her, introduced myself, and asked if she had some time to chat about her country. Like a grandmother inspecting some door-to-door salesman, she studied me for a couple of seconds. She squinted, and I could not tell what her expression meant, so I waited. Maybe she was worried about her group, which included a security officer whose responsibility was to prevent defections. I had spotted him earlier. She was still inspecting me. I began to wonder if she would walk away or call security or scream, "CIA, CIA!" "Well, of course," she responded in accented English. "Maybe I can buy you a cup of tea," I asked. With an impish grin, she thrust her head toward the cafe, and we strolled over to a table. The next 30 minutes were a refreshing interlude. She seemed equally bored by the conference and welcomed the chance to talk about her country and her family. She may have suspected my intelligence affiliation, but seemed unflappable, confident, and enthused about our polite exchange of political and personal views. I broached nothing sensitive, just worked to build a degree of understanding and rapport in the short time we had. At the conclusion, I repeated my name, rather than offering her a business card, given the risk that could pose. She did not need or want to have the card of a U.S. official in her possession when she returned home. She, however, offered me one of her cards. I would not see her again for 4 years. By then, I was on another overseas assignment. Again, a foreign liaison service was the key. They had spotted her name on a list of visitors scheduled to attend another international conference in a city on the other side of the globe. The COS walked into my office and instructed, "Pack your bags." "Sure, where to?" He placed an envelope on my desk and, as he walked out, advised, "The food there is really good." I opened the envelope and read the eyes-only cable. The CIA seemed almost desperate, launching me on such a long journey to seek another conversation with the same target from 4 years earlier. Clearly, we had only a few clandestine sources, if any, in that country. The next day, I was hurtling east at 30,000 feet. When I arrived at the airport, the immigration